My name is Carl Strady. I teach at Capital in Columbus, and I'll be doing biblical studies for the next 5 days here and then also into next week. I had some sessions last week and was trying to feel around for some sort of ideas to how to approach topics, and particularly I wanted to center around this business of heresy. Hierel is a Greek word from which we get our word heresy. And as I was saying, as I started out last week, I'm teaching a class in heresy. Heresy meaning literally to choose. It's come to take on negative connotations about making wrong choices, or what many people feel are wrong choices. But I think usually when we get back to the beginnings of words, they can be very helpful. Hireo, hirein, to choose. And as I was working last week, I was saying as we get serious about biblical studies, we find there are choices of material within the Bible. But this week I'd like to work more with the kind of idea or problem I was working with, in the latter part of last week. And that is that we have not only to choose within different kinds of texts and ideas within the Bible, but a great deal rests on the way we go about making the choices. More technically, what I want to deal with here today and in the following session is the topic of hermeneutics. The question of how to approach the Bible. And what I want to point out is that there are very different methodologies, very different kinds of approaches. And we all know that the way you go about asking a question does much to determine what kind of answer you're going to get, or the kind of tool you use is very important in working with any particular project. If I use a hammer to saw a board, I'm likely to have very poor results. By the same token, I can take a certain kind of approach into biblical studies, or I can take a certain kind of tool or methodology or set of presuppositions into biblical studies, and I think end up doing the same thing as trying to saw a board with a hammer. So I want to work with different kinds of approaches, and I think probably the best thing, one of the most helpful and freeing things to do, is to sketch out the history of the interpretation of the Bible in the church. Now, I've got only a few sessions, and tomorrow or the next day I'll be handing out some bibliography for those who would like to study this further. But I think as we look back over how the Bible's been used in the church, we can get some room and freedom and distance for making choices that we find more meaningful than if we simply assume there's a Bible and everybody either understands it this way or they're wrong. Everybody either approaches it this way or they're wrong. Rather, throughout the history of the church, I think four basic methodologies have emerged, four basic approaches to the Bible: the allegorical approach, literalistic, rationalistic, historical, critical. And what I'd like to do is to sketch out where these came from historically and what they mean. I'd like to have you interrupt any time you want and ask questions. Now, I'm going to say quickly over again in a little illustration here what I was trying to say a little bit more technically. So if you do like I do, and for the opening 5 minutes of any session, pretty much start getting awake or adjusted in your seat or whatever, now I can listen and I'll tell you what I want to get into. One of my kids did this picture back about, they're not here this morning, so I won't embarrass you either, back about 5-6 years ago, and I don't know what you can see there, but be gracious to it. It's a kid's drawing, and what is it? A bird, and more specifically?
Woodpecker.
A red-headed woodpecker. The one kid drew it, and the other kid came in and picked it up off the table like this. And he said, "Pete, that's really a nice vulture you drew." Okay? So see, if you're willing, you can see a red-headed woodpecker here. You can tip it this way, and you can see a vulture. The big hooked beak and so on. Okay, that's what I want to get into. Something I think everybody is troubled with in one way or another is this. We take the same Bible, the same set of sacred books, source and norm of Christian teaching. And since 200 AD, there's not really been a great deal of disagreement or argument over what those books should be. And yet since 200 AD, we've gone 99,000 or however many different directions. In the history of Christianity, we've taken the same Bible and gone so many different ways. How come? Or in your own neighborhood, there are probably, as a kid in Wisconsin, I remember growing up, and there were not only dozens of churches in the neighborhood, there were three Lutheran churches within about a mile and a half of each other. Everybody said the Bible is the source and norm of our teaching, and we're serious about it. I don't doubt their sincerity at all. But we went so many different directions. You've been in discussions, bull sessions, arguments. We take the same biblical text and we understand it so many different ways. How come? Now, I think this is a very important topic. We can understand the differences in our society, many of the differences in our society, and we can get a hold of some very important tools for getting into source and norm of Christian teaching. So again, Bible is central. What does it mean to be Christian? That's the basic document. How do we get into it? Many different ways. Now, much of what I'm doing has to be an oversimplification, but what I want to do is to sketch out against historical background where these four different approaches came from. Okay, going back into the early church, back into early Christianity, by about 200 AD, as I was saying, the set of official books had been pretty well decided. Since about 200, not too much argument in that area. But how do you go about approaching it? How do you go about understanding these documents? Well, in the early church, a couple of centers of study in early Christianity were Antioch up in Syria and Alexandria down in Egypt. Another thing, well, before I get started into this, you're going to have to hang loose for a couple of days to get a hold of these tools, and then we'll see where they go as we take up specific texts. I'll be using some textual illustrations along the way, but I think it's more helpful to sketch out the history first and then apply them to some of the texts in the Synoptic Gospels, like Baptism of Jesus, Parable of the Sword, Parable of the Talents. Okay, two different schools of thought developed in early Christianity. Antioch up in Syria. The people there said some things that always seemed to me to really make a great deal of sense, and I'm not sure why all the detours since. But the people at Antioch developed what's usually referred to as the historical grammatical approach. They said if you want to deal with a passage, like the one I used for illustration last week, say, Isaiah 9, verses 1 to 7, the people at Antioch said, you want to get into Isaiah 9, verses 1 to 7, you need to deal with the text in its historical setting. Okay, you've got to try to figure out when Isaiah was writing, what the situation was. Thus, the historical part and grammatical. They said, instead of studying the Bible in our language, it's Syriac, or instead of studying it in Latin or whatever, you study the Bible in its original tongue. Now, if you're thinking that makes for a lot of work down the road, but still, everybody who's taken any foreign language knows also that things do get lost in translation. You can't simply move from one language to another with the exact equivalents in a great many cases. So they said language and history are very important in getting into an understanding of what the biblical text means. The other school of thought developed at Alexandria, down in Egypt, another center of early Christian learning, a university town for centuries and centuries. And at Alexandria, down in Egypt, there developed what is called the allegorical approach to biblical studies. Now, everybody somewhere back along junior high school memorized the definition for allegory, and the definition probably went something like this. An allegory is an extended metaphor. And earlier you'd memorize the definition for a metaphor. This is that kind of thing. But I think in trying to get into what an allegorical approach is, instead of that formal definition, maybe if we could give some examples out of literature. Can you think of any? Or maybe to save time, I can mention a couple. Probably everybody's read Swift's Gulliver's Travels. Okay? Some parts or version of it. Gulliver's Travels is an allegory. Swift is talking about the social political situation in his own time of writing. An allegory, I think we can define like this. In an allegory, things aren't what they seem on the surface. Things aren't what they seem on the surface. You have to dig beneath the surface for the deeper hidden meaning. How do you dig? There's where the problems come in, as we'll see. Another recent allegory was Philip Roth's Our Gang. Our Gang by Philip Roth. Has anybody read that? It's a recent allegory, a political satire. It came out, I think, about 1970, well before Watergate, but see if you can dig beneath the surface and get at who he's talking about. the story starts out in the basement locker room of the White House. There the president, whose name is Trick E. Dixon, is meeting with his advisors, one of whom is a spiritual advisor, named the Reverend Billy Cupcake. Okay? And so on with the story. In the case of Roth's Our Gang, we're close to the situation, and it's not very subtle, so we have no trouble digging. In the case of Swift's Gulliver's Travels, We need a guide. We need some sort of clue to what he means underneath the surface. Okay, in a long, rather complicated history, the idea came into Christianity that the scriptures were allegories, and you needed to dig beneath the surface to get at the deeper hidden meaning. A first century Jew by the name of Philo, a Jewish scholar in Alexandria by the name of Philo, was apparently the first person to apply the allegorical approach to the Bible. Philo was a Jewish scholar in Alexandria. Alexandria was a Greek town, university town at the time, and many of the Greek people would say to be Jewish and scholar, as Philo was really a contradiction in terms. You could be one or the other. There was a great deal of hostility between Jew and Greek, periodic pogroms against the Jewish community. The Jewish scholar was looked on as barbaric and superstitious. Philo set for himself the task of reconciling Jewish religion and Greek philosophy, and he did this by reading allegorically the Old Testament. For example, in a passage in Genesis 12, it says that Abraham moved from Haran, a place up in northwestern Mesopotamia. He was called by God out of Haran to go to Palestine, Israel, the Holy Land, as his inheritance. Philo looks at that passage and he says, there's no sense in having Abraham's travelogues in your sacred books. Why do that? Obviously, that's not the important sense. Rather, Philo says you have to dig beneath the surface, allegorize the scripture. And he says, Haran represents a material existence. The Holy Land represents a spiritual existence. What Genesis 12 is really talking about is Abraham's development from being materialistic to being spiritual. Okay? So that, roughly and quickly, is the allegorical approach. Dig beneath the surface, find the deeper hidden meaning. Okay, Origen, an early Christian scholar up around 150-200, also working in Alexandria, borrowed from Philo this allegorical approach and decided that this was the way to study the Christian scriptures. And Origen did it this way, for example. He'd take the passage in the first chapter of John's Gospel where John the Baptist and Jesus get together. Jesus comes to John the Baptist to be baptized. And John says, does anybody remember? I'm not worthy to untie the thongs on your sandals. I'm not worthy to untie the thongs in your sandals. Origen says, no sense in having talk about shoes and shoelaces in your holy books. Obviously, the surface meaning is not important. Allegorize it. Dig beneath the surface. Find its secret hidden meaning. And he goes into about a 10-page passage there where he allegorizes that text. And he says, the one shoe represents Christ's descent to earth. The other shoe represents Christ's descent to hell. And he goes on and he develops really some interesting, very, very helpful theology. He comes out with some very neat ideas. And he finally concludes, he who correctly understands the relationship between the two shoes knows what Christianity is all about. But okay, what's the problem? Well, the obvious problem is, why does shoe mean descent to earth? The other shoe descent to hell. Why not make one Holden and the other Seattle or whatever? One Republican and the other Democrat. Well, what I'm saying is, with the allegorical approach, something important is being realized. That is, that there is oftentimes a symbolic intent in the literature, or that the literature is meant symbolically. But what's the obvious glaring problem with the allegorical approach? Well, with a little ingenuity, you can find in the scripture anything you want. Absolutely anything you want. And this becomes a very serious matter when we say these are our sacred books and we're working out our guidelines for all facets of living. Because I can say, look, I'm being very biblical. I can quote a text, allegorize it, and come out miles from what the author intended. What I come out with may not be bad. I was saying, in the case of Philo or Origen and that text in John, I think it's really a remarkable passage of theology. But it's not, I don't think, what John the Baptist, or what Jesus, John, the author of the fourth gospel, and John the Baptist, I don't think it's what that story is about. In allegory, there are no controls within the situation for finding out what the author means by symbols, or whether or not he has symbols in mind. Rather, with the allegorical approach and a little ingenuity, you can find in the text absolutely whatever you want. And interestingly, we talk about getting back to the good old time religion, and interestingly, if we were to do that historically, we'd go back to the allegorical approach. Because for much of Christian history, and I would say still in the present, it's the allegorical approach which has dominated our study of the scriptures. I want to talk about this more in a day or two, but
I would say it's something like probably three-fourths of the biblical study and the preaching that we do today still uses the allegorical approach. And I think that's really a very serious kind of matter. Each of these methodologies is a choice. I might choose the allegorical approach, but I think it's something I should choose rather than something I fall into unwittingly. Going back to Origen, Origen made the allegorical approach even more complicated. He came out with the idea that every passage of Scripture has four senses. Every passage of Scripture has four senses. A literal sense, and then he allegorizes it, and different terminology is used in the literature here, but I would rather see it this way. He allegorizes it theologically, he allegorizes it morally, and he allegorizes it eschatologically. So he says every passage has a literal sense, that's not too important. You have to allegorize every passage to find the theological sense, allegorize it to find a moral meaning, and allegorize it to find some sort of idea about the end of time and history, an eschatological sense. This approach, this fourfold approach of Origen's, we can illustrate it by taking some examples out of the Middle Ages. One of the great theologians in Christian history, Thomas Aquinas, for example, taking a passage out of Isaiah, I forget the reference, there's a reference there to Jerusalem. And using Origen's fourfold approach, he says what? One, literally, it's a city in the Holy Land. Allegorize it theologically, it's the church. Allegorize it morally, it's the believer's soul. Allegorize it eschatologically, and it's heaven. Okay? And so systematically, every passage, four senses. Okay, Alexandria won out, and Antioch lost. And for the whole long stretch of the Middle Ages, from roughly 400 to 1500, as Christians approached the Scripture, they tended to use Origen's fourfold approach to allegorize the materials. Going back in the Middle Ages, someone has found a student's study manual. He's getting ready for a test. He does like students do today. He's trying to get a hold of little mnemonic devices and jingles and whatnot so he can get through the exam, you know, hold on to it long enough to get through the exam. And I don't know if I can quote it, but coming out of the Latin, there's a little jingle like this. He's memorizing Origen's fourfold approach. The letter shows us what God and our fathers did. The allegory shows us where our faith is hid. The moral gives us rules for daily life, and the eschatological tells us where we end our strife. Okay, so it's a very cumbersome translation, but again, the letter shows us what God and our fathers did, not too important. The allegory theologically shows us where our faith is hid. Moral gives us rules for daily life. The eschatological shows us where we end our strife. And in graduate study, I was working particularly with this business of methods of interpretation, and going into the Middle Ages, I found out that some people not only worked with the fourfold approach, but eightfold, 16, and as many as 32. So you go into a passage of Scripture and say four senses or maybe 32 senses in this one passage of Scripture. One more illustration, and we'll move on from the allegorical approach. In the Middle Ages, typically a book would look like this, a book in the study of Scripture. A passage of Scripture quoted up at the top of the page, maybe Isaiah 9, verse 1, we were working with last week. And then beneath it, a list of people. Augustine dealt with the passage, allegorized the passage this way. John of Damascene this way, and so on. So you list maybe half a dozen scholars, and oftentimes what you'd be doing would be giving their allegorization of that passage. Then down at the bottom of the page, the guy doing the writing would give his interpretation. And he would do one of two things. Usually he would either take Origen's fourfold allegorical approach, and he'd allegorize Isaiah 9, verse 1, or else, oftentimes, he would do this. He would allegorize somebody else's allegory. Okay? He'd allegorize somebody else's allegory. What he'd come out with might be very profound, meaningful theology. But it would be only a happy accident if it related to the text. So the allegorical approach then, it seems to me, leads farther and farther away from the text. And I think the task in biblical studies is, like I was saying last week, exegesis, to lay bare what the author intends. And I'm saying it seems to me there are an awful lot of problems with the allegorical approach. With a little ingenuity, I can find most anything there that I want. And I want to illustrate the use of the allegorical approach in the present when I get up into the contemporary period. But roughly 200 to 400, the age of the fathers in church history, was a time of contest between Alexandria and Antioch,
Alexandria and the allegorical approach won out, and during the Middle Ages, from 400 to 1500, the allegorical approach dominated. This brings us up to the next period in church history, the Reformation. And the Reformation will date roughly 1500 to 1575. Luther and Calvin, particularly the important figures at this time, at least for us Lutherans and Presbyterians. Okay, Luther and Calvin are both, of course, deeply interested in biblical studies, and in a sense they do a rather simple, clear thing. They opt for Antioch and reject Alexandria. Or putting it in another fashion, Luther and Calvin say the allegorical approach is not very helpful. They both backed away from it, and they both sometimes used it. But basically, said the allegorical approach is not very helpful. Instead, we need to pay attention to the history, to the languages, like at Antioch, in order to get into the text. So both were deeply involved in historical, linguistic, textual studies. So in a sense, the Reformation is a rejection of the allegorical, or involves a rejection of the allegorical approach to scriptures. And then the Reformers do some other things that scholars argue about a great deal. But so, like everything else I'm saying, it's, you know, my interpretation or understanding of it. But I think it's valid to say the Reformers recognize the humanness and variety in Scripture. They recognize the humanness and variety in Scripture. For example, many people know Luther didn't like the book of James very well. So I think it's difficult to make out of Luther a typical literalist in his approach to scriptures. He uses an illustration like this. He says the Bible is like the manger. The manger is made up out of sticks and straw and stone, all sorts of things. In the manger lies the Christ child. And he says the Bible is like this, and the book of James happens to be straw. Okay, he didn't like it very much. And I'm not very comfortable with Luther's understanding of James, but the point here is this, that he was one of the people who recognized that that there are differences in theology within the biblical material, something like we looked at in a more neutral fashion with David and Goliath last week, but pushing it a little bit further, not simply what we talk about there, historical different views of history, but different theology. James and Paul are not saying the same thing. Calvin had a good bit of trouble with the book of Revelation. He of course, was an excellent scholar and so on, really didn't seem to see much of value for him in that particular book. But the Reformers then recognize this. The biblical materials are not all saying the same thing. What do I mean by that? For example, in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, the Yahwist theology, one batch of theology in the Pentateuch says God is a God of grace. Law is a guideline for living out a relationship that God gives. This is what's in Luther's small catechism. You should fear and love God. Because of what God has done, we respond. But there's another kind of theology in the Pentateuch, the Deuteronomic theology, literally a second telling of the law, that says not the relationship is gift and here are guidelines for living it out, but rather, if you keep these laws, then God will like you. And if you break these laws, then you'll get punished. So a theology of grace in the Yahwist materials, a theology of law in the Deuteronomic materials, and Ecclesiastes. I hardly ever hear a sermon preached on Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes says, do good, do bad, what difference does it make? You're all food for worms anyway. He says a bunch of other things, but he's saying something very different from the Deuteronomists, certainly the Deuteronomist approach. Ecclesiastes had trouble getting in the canon. There's a little footnote on the end of the book that says, paraphrasing it, it's okay to read it, but you shouldn't take it too seriously. But there is that kind of variety, and the Reformers in our tradition, I think, recognize that. There's theological variety, and the biblical materials are written by people. I think it was John Yoder the other day quoting the passage, someone in here, about Jesus having a choice of using seven legions of angels and choosing not to do it. God chose not to stomp down sacred books by way of angels, but to use people. And I think it's very important for us to take seriously that they're people akin to us, with their own concrete setting and problems and history and virtues and vices and so on. And it's out of people with all their problems and with their variety that they come to us, our sacred scriptures. Luther, again, the Bible's like the manger. It's made up out of all sorts of things. In the manger lies the Christ child. So he's saying source and norm of Christian teaching is the Bible. But it's not as clear and simple as one might hope. So the Reformers backed off from the allegorical approach and gave us some tools, I think, that we've picked up with over the last couple of hundred years, and I think developed a little further. But I think it's important to see some of the things, at least according to my interpretation, happened with biblical studies in the time of the Reformation. No, that's fine. If I skip over something or use terms you're not familiar with or whatever, be sure you check on it. The literal sense. And then in the literature, you will find usually different terms. But I think it's most helpful to see three allegorical senses. An allegorical theological sense, allegorical moral sense, and an allegorical eschatological. Anybody in here have Janice Rosenthal's at the seminary in St. Paul for one of the teachers? He used to give us great and terrible German names like Tischendorf and von Rheda and so on, and whip through them without batting an eye. And then he'd come to an East Latvian in background. He'd come to an English name like Lake, and he'd say Lake, L-A-K-E, Lake. Okay, so historically, then we're up to about 1575, and. We've seen basically a clash between a historical grammatical approach and an allegorical approach, and the allegorical approach dominating for a long time. The Reformers backing off from it. The Reformers come out with some very scary ideas, radical ideas about the responsibility of the single one before God. Radical ideas about our responsibility for each other, priests to each other, and so on. And what happens historically when somebody comes along with a bunch of scary ideas? What happens in the following period? Jefferson, for example, says something like, we need a good revolution every 5 years. Well, we didn't do that. When a movement comes along with a bunch of radical and scary ideas, the next period usually backs off and tries to domesticate, tries to get some handles on it. And I think exactly that happens in the period following the Reformation. In church history, typically we talk of the post-Reformation period, and the post-Reformation period dates from roughly 1575 to 1750. And I think it's a very important period for understanding some of the developments in Christian approaches to the Bible. Kind of time. Okay. So the Reformation does a whole bunch of scary things. The control of the princes is up for question. The security that I could find within the medieval sacramental system is up for question. There's turmoil across the face of Europe. For example, 1618 to 1648, the 30 Years' War, a bloody, devastating war. Like all wars, I think, fought for many reasons, but a prominent reason for the 30 Years' War was one's religion. During the 30 Years' War, face of Europe divided up into little principalities. If I was a good Catholic and my prince was a Catholic, I might live in some peace. If there was a palace coup or my prince died, I might wake up the next morning and find out that I lived in a territory ruled by a Lutheran prince and I was Catholic. And I'd be faced with choices like this. I could decide I wasn't that serious about being Catholic and convert, or I could run across the border into another territory where there was another Catholic prince, or I might literally end up getting my head chopped off. So it's a time of extreme tension, and a tension over many issues, but one of the issues then is religion. Now, I think what happens in that period is something that we see happening in different fashions in our own lifetime as well. And what we'll see emerging here, I think, is what we've come to label literalistic or fundamentalistic approach to Scripture. War is going on the battlefield over religious issues. But if you were a student in the seminary during that post-Reformation period, the age of orthodoxy, taking your classes, oftentimes you'd take classes in polemics. And polemics, a Greek word, polemos, war. You take classes in polemics in which you'd be learning how to do war with other theologians' ideas. So war on the battlefield, war between scholars. And what proceeds, I think, really is kind of a common sense matter. When you clash in an argument, it's a friendly one or otherwise, a bull session or something more important. Two people or two sides choose up, they go back and forth, and oftentimes, I suppose everybody's had this experience, you come down finally saying, look, you're wrong and I'm right, and the other guy says, no, look, you're wrong and I'm right. So what do you need to do in that situation, or what do we do? Say we're arguing about, let's make it something trivial, what's the greatest football team in the history of the National Football League? Well, in Wisconsin, we all know it's the Lombardi Packers. But if somebody else had a different idea, how do you argue? Well, you argue back and forth, but finally you need what? An authority to support your position. Guinness Book of World Records or whatever. So when it comes down to you're wrong and I'm right, vice versa, we try to resolve the situation by getting an authority to support our side. And again, this is a terrible oversimplification, but taking basically Protestants and Catholics in the age of orthodoxy, what develops? Now, an important thing to see here that I don't think Protestants have paid enough attention to. Everybody, Protestants and Catholics, say the source and norm of Christian teaching is the Bible. Okay? The source and norm of Christian teaching is the Bible. But Catholics say, how do you sort out the different interpretations of the Bible? It seems to me they've got a good thing going there. They're saying, look, you take the same Bible and you understand it differently. How do you tell whose interpretation is right? And at that time, there develops, not altogether new, but there develops a strong interest in the teaching office of the papacy, what we've come to call the infallibility of the Pope. In essence, what they say is the papacy has the right and the duty to sort out the correct interpretation. The papacy has the right and the duty to sort out the correct interpretation. You're in an argument, you're wrong, I'm right, vice versa, the other guy whips out an authority. What do you need? An authority to counterbalance his authority. And so Protestants also develop a position on authority during the age of orthodoxy, the post-Reformation era. And it's sometimes referred to like this. In Protestantism, there develops the idea of a paper pope, an infallible, inerrant Bible. But what's the question we've left hanging? Everybody takes the same Bible and they go different directions. And then there develops within Protestantism something that seems really strange to me, the idea of what they call the perspicuity of Scripture. And I don't think I'm doing an injustice when I say what they meant by that was that the Bible, the correct interpretation, is perfectly clear to anybody with good intentions. Some of the people in the room know the writings of Oscar Kuhlmann. It seems to me that Oscar Kuhlmann in his technical literature on interpretation comes down to finally very much the same position. The right interpretation is perfectly clear, which is just another way of saying good guys agree with me. Okay, so I think it's important to approach it sympathetically. People are literally living and dying over religious issues. The question of authority, the papacy, the right and duty to sort out the correct interpretation. The same Bible, Protestants, it's infallible, inerrant, and perfectly clear. Not the only place, but one of the basic places where the literalistic or fundamentalistic approach to Scripture develops. And I think if we can look back on it and sympathize with it historically, we can see some of the reasons behind that kind of development. We can see, we've got some room. We can see how it happened there, and we can also see that it's not the only way of approaching or studying Scriptures. Applying the infallible, inerrant idea has a number of problems, I think. But I can see it as a choice and respect it as a choice of approach to Scripture. The kinds of problems I would see with that approach to Scripture, the sort of thing that we were talking about with the story of David and Goliath last week. Who killed Goliath? 1 Samuel 17, David. 2 Samuel 21, Elhanan. 1 Chronicles 25, Elhanan kills the brother of Goliath. Some of you were here when we talked about that last week.
some not. But what I'm saying is, biblical study, taking the Bible seriously, raises, I think, some real problems for the literalistic approach. And then also, problems are raised by other contemporary studies, like, for example, geology and the seven-day creation kind of thing. So contemporary science, contemporary biblical study, not just contemporary, but biblical study, I think raise some serious problems for a literalistic approach. If you want, later on in the week, we can come back if it's important to people and spend some time going over in detail some of the problems. But I'm not so much concerned to argue against it as to say we have choices of approach. If we go into the biblical materials, allegorizing them, we're going to come out one way. If we go in with literalistic presuppositions, infallible, inerrant, perfectly clear, we're going to come out, I think, with a different understanding. Okay, during the age of orthodoxy, then, the post-Reformation period, 1575 to 1750, the development of a literalistic approach to scriptures within Protestantism. Another problem, as I would see it, that developed during the age of orthodoxy, systematics is one of the important branches, of course, of Christian theology. In systematics, we're trying to take up and give coherent, consistent reasoning about the nature and direction of the Christian faith. And from the beginning of Christianity on up through the present, it's one of the basic disciplines. Systematics during the age of orthodoxy developed like so. I remember in Luther Seminary back in St. Paul, we had a set of the systematics of Paul Gerhardt from the age of orthodoxy. They were huge books. They're about this high and about this thick and about this wide, a shelf about like so. In those systematics, Gerhardt, as a typical age of orthodoxy systematician, is taking up and giving systematic answers to all of the questions, doctrinal issues. And this is not a quote from Gerhard, but typically like this. To be Christian is to believe in God. Point A. Subpoint, God is triune. How do you know? Okay? And you've taken that position on the Bible. It's inerrant, infallible, perfectly clear. You set up your doctrinal positions. And then during the age of orthodoxy, the Bible typically came to be used as a collection of proof texts. So this is my idea. How do I know whether it's right or not? If I quote a proof text out of an infallible, inerrant, perfectly clear source, then I have guaranteed my interpretation is correct. See what I mean? Okay, so you start out, I believe this, and then you find a biblical passage to fit under it. Now, biblical studies is my discipline, and so I think that's upside down. I think it ought to be the other way around. First of all, you go to the biblical text and say, what does it say? And then from there, go into building up the systematics. But typically then, during the age of orthodoxy, it seems to me things got tipped upside down. I start, this is caricature yet, to make the point, I start with what I'm going to believe, and then I find a biblical text to support it. Okay, and what I come out with may be all well and good, but if not, then I certainly set up a number of massive problems. Any questions at this point? We've got just a couple of minutes. Let's take it for any kinds of questions we need to check back over here.
What is Hip touched upon the rationalistic? Is that which we call orthodoxy or what? He spoke of four approaches.
Yeah, we'll get into these tomorrow.
All right.
Down here. Basically, they're talking about allegory and about the one of the important points in the background development of the literalistic or fundamentalistic approach. Yes?
That in the Roman Catholic Church, Pope decides what the Bible means, interprets the Bible. You did not mention the idea of settled questions that come up in the Protestant circles. Questions of Bible interpretation that are settled by in various Protestant denominations, the equivalent of the Roman Catholic idea that is held local. I thought you might properly mention that. You also have this infallibility in the non-Roman Catholic circles.
Do you have some particular theological points or settled points in mind there?
Well, I believe that the idea of church confession even touches on the idea of interpretation of the Bible. One of the purposes of church confessions is to indicate what a denomination believes pertaining to certain aspects of the Bible. Also, I think the idea of settled questions is a familiar term in certain Lutheran circles. I thought you might mention that.
Yeah, no, that's good to bring that up. Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I'm sure you can see other holes around the corner here. Are there other things that need mentioning? Or terms that need clarifying before we... I think I'll make up a list of bibliography and try to have that done for tomorrow and pass it out. But I think one of the best things for people to read on this particular topic, if they're interested in pursuing it a little further, Robert Grant's Short History of the Interpretation of the Bible. Robert Grant, The Short History of the Interpretation of the Bible. Okay, tomorrow what I'd like to do then is to proceed with this sketching out historical critical approach and rationalistic approach against a historical background. And then to illustrate it, and I don't know, we'll see, we can either take some materials out of apocalyptic or we can move directly into some texts in the synoptics, like the baptism of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, to talk about where these different tools go.